From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. There's a new book out called Dr. Feelgood, the true story of Dr. Max Jacobson and how he changed history by manipulating those like President Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis, and many, many others. And I'm thrilled to have Bill Burns, the author of that book, on the show tonight. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Dana. Glad to be here.
Everyone's heard the term Dr. Feelgood, I believe, myself included. And, of course, history buffs like myself know exactly who Dr. Feelgood was. But please educate the audience about Dr. Max Jacobson, and we'll get into the book.
Okay, well, Dr. Feelgood was the code name given to this medical doctor, Max Jacobson, who was a German immigrant who came to New York City in the 1930s, right before the war. He fled the Holocaust. He fled Germany. And he had synthesized a drug, which we now know as methamphetamine, but he'd synthesized a drug ostensibly to cure people who had blood disease and neuromuscular diseases. But the drug's main strong point, its main function, was to make people really feel fabulous, because it generated this neurochemical called dopamine, and dopamine excites the pleasure centers in the brain. And so the Secret Service, he was injecting methamphetamines into a bunch of show business people, Tennessee Williams, the famous writer, Truman Capote, singers like Eddie Fisher, Andy Williams. He was injecting them. And methamphetamine is chemically addictive. So it's not just habit forming. It's not just like, I can't get by without my hit today. No, this is chemically addictive, because the brain's pleasure center looks for dopamine, and this drug mimics the effect of dopamine in the brain. So you become chemically addicted. And it really is a narcotic. But back then, back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, the drug was perfectly legal. It was a medical drug. In fact, kids get it today in Adderall and Ritalin.
Right.
Well, when Senator Kennedy's ex-roommate at Harvard, Chuck Spalding, recommended that Kennedy see Max Jacobson because he was lethargic, he was fatigued, he was in pain, he couldn't walk, he was an invalid, by the way, because of his back, and he had to face Richard Nixon in these series of debates, when Chuck Spalding, Kennedy's roommate, said, "Look, you got to see this doctor, he makes me feel good, he'll make you feel good." Jacobson gave Kennedy an injection. Kennedy bounced out of there. He gave him another injection right before the first debate with Nixon that really, I think, changed the course of history, because Nixon was ahead in the polls. And when Kennedy became president, he was visiting Jacobson, getting his shots two times a week, and the Secret Service codenamed Jacobson Dr. Feelgood, and the name stuck.
You're listening to Bill Burns in his new book, Dr. Feelgood. And we're talking about the doctor that was the injector of the stars, I guess, so to speak. Did they know what they were being injected with? I've heard that Kennedy said that he didn't care if it was horse pee, as long as it made him feel good.
That's right. That's exactly right. Jacobson told his patients, these are vitamin stimulants, right? I'm going to give you a vitamin shot. It's going to make you feel good. That's what Jacobson said. But because of the extreme high, and just to, you know, clarify this, the high was such that it made you feel invincible, invulnerable. You could rule the world. A psychiatrist would say it's called hypergrandiosity, where you feel invincible, that you're not rational anymore, okay? That's what psychiatrists say. But the reverse of that, when you were lacking that methamphetamine high, was a clinical depression so deep. So the side effect was bipolar disorder, extreme mania, and then extreme depression.
Wow.
So it was a serious drug with serious side effects.
Bill Burns is here talking about his new book, Dr. Feelgood. You can click on the link in the show notes to pick up the book through Amazon and, of course, all your other bookstores. When we talk about some of the celebrities, Marilyn Monroe, for example, we've all seen the famous video clip of her singing Happy Birthday to the President. She was high as a kite then, was she not?
Well, yeah, people thought she was drunk, that she had a lot to drink. She got out, she stumbled on stage, and she was slurring her words. Actually, no, she had stage fright. Marilyn Monroe was not a stage performer. She made movies, and she performed for camera, not for a live audience. So when she was in Madison Square Garden, ostensibly to sing Happy Birthday to the President, who was having an affair with her, which is why Jackie wasn't there at her husband's birthday party, she was afraid to go on. She wouldn't go on. So what the Max Jacobson did, who was also at Madison Square Garden for the party, he injected her with a very high dose of methamphetamines. She stumbled onto the stage, and that explains her the way she performed. And folks could see that Happy Birthday, Mr. President. On the internet, you could find it in a bunch of different videos.
Absolutely. If you go to drfeelgoodbook.com, Doctors DR, you'll learn more about the book. Let's talk about some of the other celebrities that Mickey Mantle, for example, the one of the first baseball players, I guess, that was on steroids.
Right. The thing with Mantle was he was in this home run derby in 1960-61 with Roger Maris.
Right.
And the two of them were having a slugfest. Who could break Babe Ruth's record of 60 home runs? Who could do it? And who could do it in the number of games that Babe Ruth played? Because remember, there was a longer season in Major League Baseball by 1960. And Mantle was getting sick. First of all, he had very bad knees to begin with. He had a torn tendon in his knee, in the back of his knee, and he was playing in pain. And what happened was that Mel Allen, who's the voice of the New York Yankees, when Mantle was down saying, I can't do this, I'm losing my edge, Mel Allen said to Mickey Mantle, Mick, I'm going to take you to this doctor. I'm one of his patients. He's going to fix you up. Trust me. He took him to Max Jacobson. Jacobson gave him a shot. And supposedly Mantle complained to his wife. Now, Mantle was no poster boy of virtue. The guy was seeing prostitutes. He had checked into Betty Ford. He long extended his career. So he goes to Jacobson. He gets a shot right in the hip. He says it infected his hip. He had an inflamed hip. But according to other stars like Eddie Fisher, for example, Mantle kept on going back to Jacobson, and Jacobson was giving him steroids as well as methamphetamines that prolonged his career. So Mantle was one of the first baseball players actually to have his career prolonged by steroids. Like a Mark McGwire, like a Barry Bonds, like a Sammy Sosa.
I was going to say, it's fascinating from what we're hearing today. And Bill Burns, when you look at the history of entertainment, and we all have, especially lately, the scourge of prescription medication and some of the stars that are dying because of their addictions to it. Did we hear much about addictions in the 50s, 60s? I can first think of Elvis, for example, when he passed away and all his problems. Elvis, too, was a patient of Dr. Jacobson.
Yes, he was. Not a long-term patient, but a patient, because Colonel Parker was a patient. Colonel Parker, not a colonel, not an American. He committed some kind of crime in Eastern Europe, came to America, adopted a whole new identity. But the funny thing, and you raise a really great issue here, and that is we didn't hear that much about drugs back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, but the late 60s you certainly did. But now we hear a lot about it, a lot of show business people on it. Here is my opinion for what it's worth. Before the 1970s, I would say before 1965, okay? So before the Summers of Love in the late 60s, before 65, when you thought of addictive drugs were, they had a racial stigma to them, right? So African Americans were associated with drugs. Hispanic Americans, Mexican Americans were associated with drugs. In fact, the name for cannabis is marijuana, right?
Right.
Marijuana is a made-up name. There's no such chemical as marijuana. Mary Jane, okay, MJ. There's no such chemical like that. The reason it was called marijuana was to give it a tint of ethnicity so that when they were making movies like Reefer Madness in the 1930s, it was black people and Hispanic people who were the ones who were hooked, that was going to hook your white daughter. And that was literally, it was racist. That's the whole point. So drugs had a racial edge to them. Now, one of the things that's happened is that with the proliferation of drugs, the failure of the drug war, and by the way, the drug war itself, the entire inception of that drug war, which Richard Nixon promulgated in the 70s, came out of the Max Jacobson scandal.
Yeah. And looking at Jacobson, I'm looking at Dr. Feelgood book, .com, and you have some pictures of him there. And you got to wonder with the celebrities that he's hanging out with, presidents, vice presidents, rock stars, authors, you name it. This guy looks like a schlump. He's just big, thick glasses. And how did he fit in?
Well, he was a schlump. In fact, when Kennedy first visited Jacobson in his office, when candidate Senator Kennedy visited Max Jacobson, he was appalled at what Jacobson looked like. He was rumpled. He was thin. He had dirty fingernails. He had soot all over him. His lab coat was bloodstained. He had track marks up and down his arm because he was self-injecting. That's why he lost his license.
Right.
And Kennedy was appalled, but Kennedy was feeling so sick, so fatigued, so worn out, and he's facing an election against probably one of the most powerful candidates. Remember what Kennedy had to do to win that? Well, remember, it was 1960. Yep. Think of what Kennedy had to do to win the Democratic nomination in 1960. Anybody could read The Making of the President in 1960 and get a blow-by-blow. What Kennedy did was he had to beat two powerful Senate Democrats. Lyndon Johnson, who was a literally could call in favors from anybody because he was corrupt, and Hubert Humphrey. And Hubert Humphrey was a very important figure in the Democratic Party because Hubert Humphrey in 1948 at the Democratic Convention, he was the one, Humphrey was the one that was responsible for the 1948 Civil Rights Plank that got Harry Truman to first begin the push for civil rights in the United States. That was liberal Humphrey, Hubert Humphrey. But he was not a great campaigner. Kennedy slaughtered him in the campaign in West Virginia. And he beat the hell out of Lyndon Johnson. That's why Johnson hated the Kennedys so much. So by the time Kennedy got to that nomination, when he had gotten the nomination at the convention that summer, he was wiped out, completely wiped out.
Bill Burns is here talking about his new book, Dr. Feelgood. Click on the link in the show notes. Without giving away the whole book, because I want the people to go out to buy the book and read it, it's fascinating. There is a very interesting portion where we talk about a beloved president, an assassinated president, running around naked in a hotel room lobby or a hallway because he's all doped up from Dr. Feelgood. Tell us about that.
Well, that's one of the side effects of the drug. The drug makes you feel, as I said, it's hyper grandiose. So there's no reality to your feeling of grandiosity. You are king of the world, right? You're Leo DiCaprio on the bow of the Titanic. You're king of the world. Nothing can stop you. And that's irrational. It also has this other terrible, terrible side effect. I mean, it's not, if you have low T or something, then it's not a terrible side effect. But it is hypersexuality. You become hypersexual. You will have sex with anybody. And Kennedy was already well known for being very potent sexually, and this drug basically made him voracious. That's why he had affairs with so many women.
Right.
Well, what Kennedy did when he would get his drug, on the one hand, on one day, he was running through the halls of the Carlyle Hotel stark naked. I mean, just, he ripped off his clothing, was running, banging on doors. He was completely delusional.
Jeez.
The Secret Service didn't know what to do. what do? Do you restrain the president? I mean, how do you put this president in a straitjacket? What do you do?
Yeah, exactly.
So they called this psychiatrist, Lawrence Hatter, one of the very important psychiatrists at Cornell Medical School, one of the teaching hospitals in the city, New York City. And he gave him a shot of either phenobarb, which Kennedy was already taking, phenobarbital for his irritable bowel syndrome, so either phenobarbital or chlorpromazine, two downers. And when Kennedy settled down, they got him back in clothing and they got him back in his room. But Kennedy was doing something else. When Kennedy would go to New York, what he would do is make these appointments, these assignations with call girls right around Central Park. He'd just slip out of a Secret Service detail and wind up with a woman in some apartment. And the CIA was frantic about this because they said, what if Kennedy is talking out of school, which they knew he was doing, by the way. They knew that he was shooting off his mouth about state secrets because they haven't had a transcript of one. So that was one. And the other was, what if one of those women that Kennedy was seeing was a prostitute, or was not a prostitute, but a Soviet agent? What if KGB inserted into one of those women a spy? And what if they could have kidnapped the president? I mean, can you imagine? You're the head of the CIA. You're Alan Dulles, when Alan Dulles was fired in 1961. But you're the head of the CIA. And you've got a president who has one of the highest, not the highest, by the way, there are like 10 or so degrees of top secret above the what the president knows. But the president has one of the highest security clearances. He's got the codes for the guided missile, for the ICBMs. And this guy's running around, is fooling around with these women across Central Park, and any one of them could have kidnapped him. They could have gotten the codes out of him. They could have drugged him even more. They could have given him truth serum. What would you do? You're the CIA.
Well, exactly.
How do you stop it?
Exactly, exactly. Here you got a president that can't keep his pants on, and he's doped up on meth running around.
Exactly. Can't keep his pants on, can't keep his mouth shut.
Yeah.
And the CIA knew that he couldn't keep his mouth shut, because when Marilyn Monroe got angry that Kennedy had ditched her, that Bobby Kennedy wasn't seeing her, she calls Bobby, who's the Attorney General, and she makes this threat. She says, I'm going to tell the press about how you were trying to kill Fidel Castro, about that secret air base out in Nevada with all those strange things on it.
Yeah.
Well, she's talking about Area 51 and talking about the CIA plot to kill Castro. The CIA tapes her because she's considered a threat. Loose lips sink ships. They tape her, and they transcribe it, and we have a copy of that transcription.
Bill Burns is here talking about his new book, Dr. Feelgood. Just before we let you go, we're down to about 3 minutes. What happened to Max Jacobson? We know he lost his license, but what was his...
Well, after the New York Times and then Geraldo Rivera on ABC and Don Imus on radio, after they exposed Jacobson, literally, and it was a terrible exposure, Jacobson thought he was finally getting his due. They were going to, you know, memorialize him as being the savior of presidents. In fact, what the Times was doing was writing an expose. Jacobson became their tool to counter what the Washington Post had done with the Pentagon, with the all the president's men, with Woodward and Bernstein. So it was Times versus the Washington Post, and Jacobson was their instrument. So Jacobson became the poster boy for drug abuse in America. His license was pulled because he was self-injecting and selling meth without a prescription. Then, after all of that, Jacobson went into court to try and get his license back and spent the last 3 or so years of his life trying to get his license back. Cost him every cent he ever had. He died in poverty in 1975.
Wow. It's fascinating. Again, the book, Dr. Feelgood, The True Story of Dr. Max Jacobson and How He Changed History by Manipulating Those Like John Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis, and many other key figures of the 20th century. Bill Burns, thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. A pleasure to be here.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's Bill Burns. He's a author, and you know Bill. He's done lots of UFO work on TV and in radio, and, of course, this new book, Dr. Feelgood, is one that is burning up the sales, so to speak, and some of the other patients on his Max Jacobson's list, you name it, Betty Davis, Frank Sinatra, Paul Lynde, Howard Cosell, Mike Dodd,
Jose Ferrer, Richard Nixon, Hoover, you name it. It's a fascinating book, and I'm sure it'll turn into a mini-series or a movie or TV series or something. There's always something out there to tell. We're going to be back in just a minute here on Scared Monkeys Radio with a friend of the program, Richard Mutey, talking about his new book, Essays for My Father, A Legacy of Passion, Politics, and Patriotism in Small Town America. I'm Dana Pretzer. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Hey, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. A good friend of the program, Richard Mutey, is back. He has a new book, Essays for My Father, A Legacy of Passion, Politics, and Patriotism in Small Town America. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Dana. It's a pleasure to be back with you again.
Now, we were talking about crime last time. This time we're talking about politics and patriotism. Tell us a little bit about what got you writing Essays for My Father.
Well, this year, 2013, is the 100th anniversary of my father's birth. He was born in January 1913, and he had a great influence on me, on my life. As you know from my prior appearance on your show, I'm very heavily involved in politics. I served in the Navy as a pilot in the late 1960s. I teach American government and politics at a New Jersey university. And all of that really stemmed from the influence of my father when I was young. He was also involved in politics in my hometown of Ramsey, where I still live. My family's been here for more than 100 years. And I grew up thinking and talking with him and with his friends about state, local, national affairs, political affairs, and I just decided that it would honor him fittingly if I brought out this collection of my essays on the anniversary of his birth.
Now, there's a link in the show notes on how you can pick up the book, Richard's new book, Essays for My Father. But I want to ask you this question. Growing up, political issues in those days compared to today, that's all we hear is politics, right, left, right, left, right, left. Makes you think you're back marching in the army again. It's, what about it? What about politics then compared to politics today?
Well, I think we had a different breed of politician here in the States back then, Dana. Talk about an Eisenhower Republican. An Eisenhower Republican these days couldn't get elected, let alone nominated
That's right.
In the Republican Party. And we see really the congressional process. I teach American government and politics, and that involves looking back at the history of our country and the political workings of our country, and it just is not working the way the framers originally intended. Yes, they wanted divided government. They wanted three co-equal branches of government, but they wanted those branches to work together cooperatively. They wanted not to move quickly on certain important issues, and that's why they had a Senate and a House of Representatives, two separate bodies with separate means of being elected, but now it just seems like it's mostly obstructionism, and Congress, I think, has a less than a 20% approval rating in the States. I don't think young people grow up with the respect for our institutions of government that I had when I was growing up.
I was going to use the word trust. It seems like today everything we hear is about trust. The government doesn't trust the media. The media is now not trusting the government. And nobody trusts the IRS, the president, the Congress, the Senate, you name it. And it's you wonder with the young people growing up today, how difficult is it going to be in the future to have someone want to get into politics and dedicate their life to that because there's so many trust issues.
That's a good way to put it. And I fear for that future of our country, too. You're not going to have people with the breadth of experience getting involved in government. We fought over the last 10 or 11 years, we fought two wars in which 1% of our
population had any involvement at all, 1%, less than 1%. When I was growing up, when I was born, we weren't into World War II yet, but when I was growing up and getting involved in learning about politics, most of the people serving in political office had served our country and had put their lives at risk to defend these principles that we cherish. And now we don't have people dedicating themselves to service in the military, and in many ways not dedicating themselves to service in other aspects too. I mean, we had the Peace Corps back in the 60s. We had AmeriCorps. We had people teaching in poor districts in service to those districts. It's just not happening the way it used to.
Richard's book, Essays for My Father, is available. You can click on the link in the show notes to find how to pick that up. Something that we're hearing a lot about today, and something that you talk about in Chapter 1, is an immigrant's tale. Let's talk about that a little bit.
That is probably one of my favorites in the book. Immigration, illegal immigration specifically, was a hot-button topic. It's still a hot-button topic. We don't know if Congress will eventually pass the immigration bill that's pending, but when I wrote this article a few years back, and a number of these articles were previously published in newspapers, but when I wrote this particular article, I wanted to take a look at the issue from the standpoint of an illegal immigrant. And so I was able to prevail upon a friend to introduce me to someone that she knew was an illegal immigrant, someone that she was teaching English as a second language to. And I met in the dining room of my friend's apartment and sat across the table from a very remarkable woman, and took down her story and I think wrote it, portrayed it in a way that was very poignant. She reminded me a lot of my own immigrant grandmother. She was much younger than my grandmother was when I knew her, but she reminded me of the resilience and fortitude that my grandmother showed when she became a widow with 9 children at the start of the Great Depression in the United States. One of those children was my father. But this woman, this illegal immigrant, came into the United States through Mexico. She actually crossed the border illegally 3 times. The first time she came across, she worked in the United States in a sweatshop in New York City to make some money. She was a widow with 3 children. They paid her below minimum wage. They paid her piece rate, taking advantage, of as many employers do, of these people. She missed her children so much that she went back to get them and try to lead them across the border so that they could be with her in the States. They were caught on the other side of the border after crawling through a tunnel for about 300 yards and quickly transported back to the Mexico. And on the third crossing, she had sent her children across in school uniforms. Evidently, children in Mexico near the border are allowed to go to a parochial school on the Texas or the Arizona side, rather, of the border. So she sent her children across in a kind of an ingenious subterfuge and sent them across in the same uniforms as the other children were, only her children didn't return to the Mexico town where they were. They stayed over there, and she herself made it across, and now she's living in Bergen County, New Jersey. Her children are grown now, and I suggest that, when my grandmother and my 4 grandparents actually came here from Italy, when they came, they were illiterate, they were poor, and if the immigration laws were then what they are now, they never would have had an opportunity to come here.
Absolutely.
And my family wouldn't have come here. My uncles who served in the military in World War II wouldn't have served. My one uncle who flew 20 missions over Germany and France as a tail gunner in a B-24 wouldn't have had that opportunity. And I just think we have to rethink our immigration laws, and we have to do it in a humane way.
Absolutely, and I can speak from personal experience with the two daughters who immigrated into the United States from Canada, and the hoops and paperwork and cost involved. We did it right. We did it the legal way, and boy, I'll tell you, it was something. So something needs to be done when it comes to immigration. Richard's book, Essays for My Father, now available. Perfect time for Father's Day, just around the corner. Another chapter, and you were kind enough to send me a copy of the book. I'm about halfway through it, and I'm really enjoying it. Something we've been talking about many, many times on the show. And I know last time I interviewed you, we talked a little bit about gun control. What about gun control in Newtown?
Well, the whole country was hopeful that after Newtown, finally, that would be the impetus we needed to get some things done. Now, when I say some things, there are certain aspects of gun control legislation that has been talked about, that have been proposed, that really, I don't think, stand a very good chance of getting passed. For example, a ban on assault weapons. It was law previously, but in today's political climate, I think it's a waste of breath and a waste of legislative energy to try to get something like that passed. I think we made a mistake. The president made a mistake by not concentrating on certain aspects of gun control that had the best chance. He diluted the effort, I think, by going after too much at the same time. I think universal background checks was something that was supported by 90% of the public, according to pretty trustworthy polling. According to a poll taken by a Republican, a conservative pollster, Frank Luntz, 70% of NRA members supported universal background checks. And it was really a travesty that didn't get passed. I think it may have had a better chance had it been the focal point of the package and had some of these other issues not drain the energy away from the entire package. I think part of the problem, and in one of the essays in the book I detail this, and I detail it from a unique perspective. I myself am an NRA member. I'm a gun owner. I believe in the Second Amendment, and I believe that it gives an individual right to own a gun. But I believe that it is subject, like all of the rights in the Bill of Rights, subject to reasonable restrictions. And I think that, you know, we have a situation in which the NRA is really being led by a group of 76 members of the board of directors who replenish themselves with like-minded members. Because I'm an NRA member, I get their literature, and I know how the board of directors of the NRA is selected. Actually, those who are going to run for a seat on the board of directors are selected by the board of directors themselves, for the most part.
Oh,
so they are replacing themselves with like-minded individuals, and those individuals really are made up of gun manufacturers, ammunition manufacturers, people who have a vested interest in not changing anything. And I think it's just an unfortunate situation in which this small group of men and women are really blocking something that could make our citizens safer.
One of the other, and we're starting to run out of time here a little bit, but I want the people to go out and buy the book, so we won't give everything away, but something that has been debated for many years and will continue to be, and with the high-profile cases that are in the media these days, and you and I have talked about that, is, of course, capital punishment. Let's talk about your perspective. Of course, you were a prosecutor. You've tried cases. The people are wondering now, with Anthony and other cases out there, in particular this Arias case that we've heard about, the jury hung on the death penalty portion of it. What about capital punishment in the United States?
Well, I, as you mentioned, I was a prosecutor for 19 years, and I prosecuted many, many cases, some of which were capital cases, although I did not in any of the cases I tried, including some murders, did not think the circumstances were appropriate to seek the death penalty. In New Jersey, there are certain criteria that you must meet in the cases that I prosecuted, the cases of first-degree murder. We went for life imprisonment instead. But in any event, I think capital punishment is very, very diminished in its appeal to citizens. Now a large majority favor doing away with capital punishment. I think in polls, when people are given the choice of life without the possibility of parole, they overwhelmingly, by more than 70%, accept that as the maximum penalty and reject death as the maximum penalty. It's very, very rare that a jury will decide unanimously, and that's how the decision must be made, unanimously, to send a fellow human being to death. Nevertheless, although the essay in the book about capital punishment, it's titled Rethinking Capital Punishment, details some of the abuses of the criminal justice system that led to a number of innocent men being unfairly and wrongly convicted, some of whom ended up in death row and were released. Although that scenario plays out in my essay, I'm actually in favor of a very limited death penalty option in certain cases when the depravity of the murderer has been established. In other words, someone who a serial killer of children or a serial rapist killer or some measure of depravity has been reached with scientific irrefutable DNA evidence to prove the case. In other words, if there's a scientific basis of proof, and if certain criteria are met regarding the nature of the crime, I'm in favor of a limited death penalty. However, nowhere in no jurisdiction in the country is such an option available. So I guess that's something that may come forward. I mean, with a terrorist bomber like the one in Boston, certainly Massachusetts doesn't have a death penalty, but that terrorist bomber committed federal crimes too, and the federal government still has a death penalty, so he would qualify. He would also qualify probably under my criteria too.
Absolutely. Listen, the book, Essays for My Father, A Legacy of Passion, Politics, and Patriotism in Small-Town America, is available. Richard, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming on.
Dana, thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's Richard Mutey, and he's a... He's a guy with some chops, I'll tell you. He's got 100 publishing credits. He's 19 years as a prosecutor. He's a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, Harvard Business School, Rutgers Law School, and a former Navy pilot and even a mayor of Ramsey, New Jersey. So make sure and go out and pick up the book, Essays for My Father. And, of course, don't forget Bill Burns' book, Dr. Feelgood. So that's it. That's tonight's show. We covered some authors. We covered some excellent books. And hopefully you enjoyed it. Check out our webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com if you're listening live or picking up the podcast, or if you're watching us on television, Channel 7, Access 7. Great to have you too. We'll see you next time here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.